This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. We've known that the human species originated in Africa. The Out of Africa theory says that we started in Africa and from there made our way to Europe and Asia. But the details of how we made that trip, well, the details are less clear. Three different groups of scientists unlocked a small piece of that puzzle, and their work was published this week in the journal Nature. Here to tell us the details of those studies is Annalee Newitz. She's the tech culture editor for Ars Technica, based out of San Francisco, and joins us here at KQED. Welcome.
Thanks. Nice to be here.
So there are lots of studies looking at the origin out of Africa. How are these studies different?
Well, one of the things that's really great about these studies is that two of them look at modern day people's genomes to kind of trace back the diversity that we see today to an origin point. And what they did was they looked at Aboriginal Australians and people in Africa whose genomes have not really been sequenced very much. We have a lot of coverage in Europe and Asia. So this gives us a much better picture of global genetic diversity. And so once we have that, we can actually walk backward and trace it to an origin point. And what they found, this is the other piece that's very interesting, is that it seems that pretty much everyone on Earth can trace their ancestry back to one migration out of Africa that happened somewhere between 80 and 50,000 years ago. So we're talking basically anyone you meet on Earth, whether it's
wow.
Someone from Australia or someone from the Americas, they are related to you.
Wow. And do we know which direction they first went when they went out of Africa?
So we don't know for sure. One of the other studies looked purely at that question and examined how the climate had changed, particularly passages out of Africa into the Middle East and how wet it would have been. So could people, lots of people have left and actually found food and found decent places to live that weren't just super dry desert. And the times when it was much wetter and would have supported life kind of coincide with this window, this 80 to 50,000 year window, not completely. So there's still a lot of room for debate here. Plus, on top of that, we know for certain that there's evidence that people did leave Africa before that time, too. So there were already groups of archaic humans in Asia and in Europe. And so this big mob of immigrants coming out of Africa would have met those people. And we still don't really know what happened to them. There's some hints, but we're still not sure.
So there were like three studies then. There was more than one study.
Right. There were three studies, two of which looked at genetics and one of which looked at the climate that would have allowed people to leave Africa during that time.
Wow. So if we had our genetics done together, we'd see that there's some commonality.
That's right. Basically, all of us are descended from a big group of immigrants who came out of Africa.
Wow. We'll have them all over for dinner.
Have a family reunion.
Let's talk about the summer. This summer has not been so good for Arctic sea ice. There's so little of it now that the first luxury cruise liner passed through the Arctic this month and made it safely to New York.
That's right. They took the Northwest Passage and went through a bunch of incredibly vulnerable ecosystems in this area. And this past summer, we've just reached our glacial minimum. And so there's now 750,000 square kilometers of ice, which makes it the second smallest chunk of ice that we've had. The smallest was in 2012. So as I said, this is a vulnerable ecosystem, but at the same time, as the ice shrinks and we see this pattern where it's shrinking more and more, we are going to see much more activity in shipping lanes. And there's several nations that lay claim to the areas that these ships might pass through. So this is going from being an environmental issue to a kind of geopolitical issue.
Right. You know, I've always said that if you want to know the truth about something, you follow the money. And for people who don't yet believe that in global warming, the fact that all these businesses are investing so much money now and cruising and sending shipping through there shows you how much they believe in it.
Yeah, it's true. And, you know, the fact that we did have this luxury liner go through, it's kind of opening up the way for first for tourism. And now I think the next stage we're going to see is we'll look to find out. I'm very curious to find out. Apparently, Canada and Denmark have already been arguing over who owns what.
Well, the Russians have planted a flag at the North Pole, so underwater, you know. They say, we own this, and there's you're right, a very big geopolitical battle going on.
Yeah, and Norway's in there, too, so we can forward to U.S. versus Norway.
Not just in hockey. let's finally, Indiana Jones is getting high tech. Archaeologists deciphered This was really cool. An ancient scroll by X-rays and an algorithm, or what did they? They peered inside the scroll without opening it.
Right. This scroll is called the Ein Gedi scroll, and it's sort of roughly from the same place as the Dead Sea Scrolls. It's about 1700 years old. And basically what they did was they used a micro CT scan to look into the scroll that had been burned and crushed. It basically looked like a lump of coal. And a micro CT scan is just like a CT scan you get at the hospital, but it's just very high resolution. So they created this high resolution 3D image of what was inside that burned lump. And they used computer algorithms to reconstruct the surfaces of the pages. So imagine a crumpled piece of paper and trying to figure out where the surfaces are. And once they knew where the surfaces were, they were able to actually find the points where ink had been put on those pages. And they deciphered it. And they found out it was the first two chapters of Leviticus in Hebrew.
Wow. And so they could read it, but first defining the pages, and then because the ink is made out of something, they could trace the ink in it?
Right. It was made somewhat easier because the ink contained some metals, but theoretically, any ink should be visible. And it's just once you find the surface of the paper, then you look at the sort of the texture. It's not paper, of course, it's parchment, which is made of animal skin. And then you look at the texture of it and you can actually find the ink itself. So the researchers who worked on it say that soon they're going to be able to do this, even if it doesn't have metal in the ink. So they should be able to maybe read some of the other Dead Sea Scrolls and some other artifacts.
Or read something that you think you might have burned.
I mean, that's right.
Right?
You know, yeah. Right?
You know who's looking at this now. Right?
That's right. And in fact, the researchers mentioned that the intelligence community has expressed a lot of interest in this, because imagine what you could do. You could read information that was in an envelope. If someone decided to burn evidence, now there's a possibility that you can read it. So there's a lot of implications beyond archaeology for this.
Wow, that's fascinating. Thank you, Annalie.
Thanks for having me.
Annalie Newitz is the tech culture editor for Ars Technica, based out right here in San Francisco. And now it's time to play Good Thing, Bad Thing. Because every story has a flip side. When I hear a story about some natural wonder that's changing, my immediate thought is to go and see it before it's gone. The melting glaciers in Glacier National Park, the Great Barrier Reef where the corals are threatened by bleaching. You want to go see it, right, before while it's still there. Well, it turns out that, of course, I'm not alone, and many people have that urge, which may not be such a good thing. Here to tell us about the good and the bad of endangered sites tourism is Leslie Josephs. She's travel and transportation reporter for Quartz. Welcome.
Thank you.
So, it is a natural urge, right? You want to go see these things before they're gone?
Yeah, absolutely. It's kind of called last chance tourism, or FOMO tourism, the fear of missing out. This is going to be the last time I'll be able to see the Great Barrier Reef, the Galapagos Islands, or some glaciers like you guys were talking about before.
Yeah, so people exploring and seeing more of their world before it goes away, it's a good thing, is it not?
It's a good thing that these places get visibility, that the threats to them, there's more awareness of what is happening to them. That's never a bad thing. But there is an environmental impact, and this goes for both natural sites and it goes for cultural sites. Anytime you bring a mass of people into a small area, anyone who lives in New York City will tell you, can have some uncomfortable side effects.
Yeah, so what kinds of damage might they be doing when they go visit?
Well, it starts anything from burning fuel on your plane or the boat or the bus or the train that's taking you to the place. So that there's that. There's foot traffic. There's general human waste. There's introduced species. It's kind of endless of what the impacts can be. And it does depend, like, site by site, but we have very, very heavy footprints, unfortunately, as humans.
We even bring our plants with us when we go and put out these, other alien species. Speaking of specific sites, you cite the Great Barrier Reef and Machu Picchu in your article. This isn't just a problem with the natural sites.
No, it's not. And Machu Picchu is a protected site under UNESCO. It's a World Heritage Site. It's been so since the early 80s, which is a good thing. Ancient Inca citadel, 6 centuries old. And the good part of that is that when Peru's government emerged from a civil war in the 2000s, there was a boom in tourism. Everybody wanted to go. It was safer. Great. It's an economic benefit. It creates jobs. That's a wonderful thing for a country that had been struggling, creating an entire tourism industry. And in fact, Machu Picchu is the number one tourist attraction of Peru. The bad thing is the site is very, very overrun, and what that means is that, one, you can't really enjoy it as much because you are sort of like backpack to backpack in certain sites where you were once able to roam around and take a nap, I've heard, in some of these areas and enjoy it. But that does lead to degradation of the sites. There is vandalism that obviously the government of Peru wants to protect its sites from anything like that. And then there's the issue of erosion from the bus traffic that comes in. And UNESCO itself, which is there to sort of draw attention to this site and other natural and cultural wonders, they say that these are problems. Wow. And they even admit themselves that this is a downside.
So I guess some of those places, what they're doing is just limiting the number of people.
And that's a tough thing to do. And the Great Barrier Reef, which has obviously struggled a lot, and there's just been ghastly damage because of the rising ocean temperatures and coral bleaching. That's a result of that. And you could kind of limit the numbers. You could limit where people go. The Galapagos Islands and Ecuador's government does a similar thing there so that it's not overrun with tourists. But it's a tough thing to control. When there's so much demand.
Everybody wants to go see them before they're gone. You can't blame them.
Yeah, it's last chance tourism for a reason.
All right, Leslie, thank you for taking time to be with us today.
Thank you.
Leslie Josephs, she's traveling and transportation reporter for Quartz. We're going to take a break when we come back. You know, those 10,000 steps you walk every day for your health may be more mythology than science at this point. We'll talk about why that is or why it may be after the break. Stay with us. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Last week on the program, we talked about apps that gamify your workout, especially those whimsical motivators like Zombie Run, which will have you literally running for your life. But for those of you who prefer a more leisurely pace, you might be a fan of Fitbit or a smartphone that counts the number of steps you take in a day, right? Yeah, everybody has something like that. And you've probably heard fitness experts say that 10,000 steps should be your goal if you want to reap the daily benefits of exercise. 10,000 steps, that's about 5 miles a day. Well, did you ever wonder where that number comes from? Of course, it must be backed up by scientific evidence, right? Well, actually, there isn't a ton of evidence to suggest that 10,000 steps is the sort of magic number that experts claim it is. So is it more myth than science? And that's just not true for walking. All of you people standing, you know, got your stand-up desks, your converts out there, you got a stand-up desk, sorry, but the jury is still out on that one too. So what is the scientific evidence behind these fitness claims? Well, you may not believe the hype, but you can trust my next guests. Ewan Ashley is an associate professor of cardiovascular medicine and genetics at Stanford University, who worked with Apple on their fitness apps. And Bethany Barone Gibbs is assistant professor of health and physical activity at the University of Pittsburgh, who is very interested in researching that standing desk. Welcome, both of you, to Science Friday.
Well, thanks for having us.
You're welcome. Ewan, your lab at Stanford is focusing on genomics and medicine, but you do a lot of fitness research as well. What is the connection there?
Well, I think that we think about your predisposition to disease a lot of the time in terms of genomics, but what we mustn't forget is that the environment is really important too, and you have control of your behavior. Genomics doesn't predetermine your fate. Mm. You have control over your fate, and the best way to do that is to think about your lifestyle and what you do on a daily basis, what you eat, how you act.
Let's talk about that lifestyle. Let's jump right into this 10,000 steps a day. A lot of science behind that.
Not really. You know, I think we're often asked about that. It's something that comes up a lot when people have Fitbits. You mentioned in the intro, Apple Watches are counting steps and looking at it, and they say, well, where did this come from? And really, it was just kind of made up once. In fact, it was made up in Japan in the 1960s. There was a pedometer that became very popular there. Its nickname was Manpoke, which literally means 10,000 steps. And from there, the Japanese health ministry took it on, and it became kind of almost like a meme, like had a life of its own. And maybe because it's a round number, something that people can understand, or a kind of achievable goal, it became something that just became very popular.
So is anybody testing it now?
Well, there are a few. Certainly thinking about steps and physical activity is something that a number of groups are interested in. Our own group at Stanford, we, as you mentioned again in the intro, we have been working with Apple and with others thinking right. about physical activity. We have an app called My Heart Counts, and it's downloadable. It's actually a research study that anybody, almost anyone in the world, certainly in the US, can join in. And if you consent to take part in the study, it will upload the number of steps that the phone thinks that you do into the cloud, allow us to analyze it along with the rest of the population, and we can study exactly what effect of exactly how many steps are on your happiness, on your fitness and other things.
Mm-hmm. Bethany, your area of study, as I mentioned, is the standing desk, which a lot of people are using, including a lot of folks at Science Friday. Where did the idea of the standing desk, quote, being good for us, unquote, come from?
Yeah, well, first of all, you know, when we think about sitting, the way we sit today is really kind of a new phenomenon. With computers and video streaming, we sit for hours on end, sometimes without getting up. So we haven't been doing that for very long. And evidence over the past decade or so has just started to accumulate that kind of prolonged sitting is bad for us. So in theory, it makes sense if we replace some of that sitting with standing up, it would be better. But we actually don't really know that right now. The research is just developing because these sit-stand desks just started coming on the market.
So it's just normally assumed that if you're standing up, you're going to be in better shape.
Sure. Well, we have some evidence now, sort of, if you look at people who sit a lot and people who don't sit very much, the people who sit a lot have more cardiovascular disease, more type 2 diabetes, they weigh more, they have more pain, they're more likely to die early. But we don't have that really good evidence, randomized clinical trials, that show us if we change that sitting into a standing right. behavior, that is going to improve our health outcomes. Now, people are doing that research now. We're really interested in it, but we don't have the proof yet. So I'm looking forward to that developing over the next 5 to 10 years.
Let me ask both of you, do we have any idea whether if you're standing up, that makes you sort of pace a little more, or walk around a little more, get a little more exercise? I know I'm a big pacer, and I have to think something. I'm up and down the hall, you know, in the office. Ian, what do you think?
Yeah, well, certainly there's a study I was looking at recently earlier in the week that showed that fidgeting can be helpful for reducing the chances of clots in your leg, which would be a potentially important thing. We know from some past health studies that fidgeting can certainly increase your oxygen consumption a little, which can definitely help. In the study I mentioned earlier that we did, actually, we found that there was an association with the number of transitions that you did. So if you were someone who tended to get up and sit down and pace around a lot, the association was with less cardiovascular disease. As Bethany said, I think that doesn't mean that there's a causal effect. We have to go do the study to test that. But there certainly seems to be an association.
Mm.
Yeah, in our research, we're doing some where we just sort of install sit-stand desks and we just measure what people are doing with kind of the best measures we have out there that can really measure position and movement very well. And we find that people, if you install a sit-stand desk with people that are interested in it, they stand up a lot, hours a day. But the extra movement, although we do see a little bit, it's not very much. Some recent data we had showed maybe about 12 extra minutes a day. So not necessarily just installing the sit-stand desk is going to make you much more mobile, but certainly you're up and standing and maybe you would be more likely.
You know, speaking of anecdotal evidence about this, we've heard over the years all the time people who have standing jobs, they're waiters, waitresses, they're on assembly lines. Doctors, their backs are killing them. You know, they wear special shoes. I mean, it could be just the opposite. It may not be good for you too much standing.
That's a really good point. There's actually a lot more research out there that's looking at too much standing. So I think the recommendation certainly is not to stand all day. It's to alternate positions frequently and move around when you can. So I think, I think that standing all day is not good for you. Sitting all day isn't good for you. We just need to understand better if alternating between those two things is actually going to improve your health.
I think moving is really the key thing. And even from the earliest days, you know, in the late 40s, when the first studies were done, you know, back in the London buses. I don't know if you're familiar with that study.
Yeah. It's a big red thing.
Yeah. So with Jerry Morris, first of all, decided to study the conductors and compare them with the drivers because they inhabited the same environment. The difference is the conductors went up and down several hundred stairs every day, so they were moving constantly. He found the cardiovascular disease rate was half in the conductors compared to the drivers. So this was the very first indication that exercise really was good for you.
So you should be having a Stairmaster that you're working on.
Potentially.
Instead. Yeah, there's a few studies now that are trying to sort of tease out just standing. Is that going to give you a real health benefit? And, you know, the thing is that although, yes, moving is great, in our current American office culture, if you stand at your desk, you can still be working, and that's valued. And if you have to walk away, you're not necessarily still working. So there is real interest in understanding whether just standing is of a health benefit. We did some work looking at really how many extra calories does it burn to just stand up. We recently published that. And it's not a lot. If you alternate 30 minutes up, 30 minutes down, maybe you're going to burn an extra 5 or 6 calories an hour. Over a day, that's going to be 40 or 50 calories, which is not a ton, but it could build up. And it's just one small change that you can easily make that could contribute to preventing weight gain.
Mm-hmm. What about I've seen now these little tiny treadmills that's a receptionist. I've seen some receptionists. They're sort of walking very slowly. You know about that, Nguyen?
Yeah, I think that, as we said, the standing desk is the first thing. Stand up. But perhaps if the idea is to keep moving, then maybe a little treadmill desk that can go under your desk. Because as we were saying, it's hard to work if you're walking around, although you can have walking meetings. We encourage that where we are.
Wait a minute, a walking meeting.
Meeting, yeah.
How does that work?
Well, I think you just take the person who walked into your office and say, do you want to go walk outside? It's a little easier in California, you know, than some other parts of the world. But it's certainly a good, we have a beautiful campus at Stanford, and so walking people around it is a great.
Well, that's how Einstein used to say, I'm going to give it a little think, I'm taking a walk while I think about it.
Well, it gives you a little break too, gets into the outdoors, a little bit of air, plus exercise. Maybe you're saving your life. My favorite fact, actually, you know, about this is that, and it's driven from a study of 500,000 people, so the data behind it pretty good, but that if you exercise for 1 minute, you get 5 minutes of extra life.
Wow.
And that's how powerful exercise can be.
Is that something like interval training?
Doesn't have to be. In fact, if you take higher intensity exercise and map it with that same equation, it gives you a few minutes more than five minutes of extra life. So the idea that I don't have time to exercise, this is when I talk to my patients, I'm always saying, you know, you have time to exercise because every minute you exercise, you get 5 minutes more of extra life.
Do you have plans to tackle any more fitness myths along the way?
Well, certainly I think, again, a very good point made is that we haven't tested a lot of these. A lot of them come from observational evidence. They're very rational. They make perfect sense. You know, the idea of...
And they get very accepted so widely. How come they're accepted so widely without the evidence?
I think sometimes it's just it's a round number. You know, 10,000 is a good round number. It's very reasonable. I mean, the current American Heart Association, American College of Sports Medicine recommendations are to do moderate exercise for 30 minutes, you know, five times a week. And if you add that, it's about 3,000 or 4,000 steps to your sedentary steps, it takes you to about 8,000 or 9,000. So it's very reasonable. It just hasn't been tested. It's not that we did 6, 8, 10, 12, 14 and said, okay, 10 is the right number.
Because I feel so defeated when I'm only up to 8,000 instead of 10,000. But no one knows if that's the real number.
We do
so
not.
So I may be okay.
You may be okay. We don't want you to feel defeated. We want you to do more than you were doing before, because more definitely is better. But whether we don't want you to feel depressed and do less because you hit 8,500 rather than 9 or 10.
Mm-hmm. And Bethany, for you, what are you most looking forward to studying next?
Well, I'm really excited to see the results of the randomized clinical trials going on and being proposed that are going to experimentally alter sedentary behavior in populations that have a lot of prolonged sedentary behavior. So people working in offices, people in older people in, you know, that are living in managed care, and kids in schools. There is actually an awesome study that came out of Texas A&M last month that showed they installed some stand bias desks. So these are high top desks with a high stool. So they promote standing. They installed it in half the classrooms and followed kids for 2 years. And kids that were in the stand bias desks actually gained 5% less in BMI percentile points over the 2 years. So this is definitely a modest effect, but it's so exciting because when we think about the obesity epidemic and how we need to help kids and all people not gain weight, this is a real strategy that could be implemented on an environmental level.
Of course, none of this really would be possible if we didn't have all this new technology to share. To first measure, right? Measure your own activity and share it.
I think that the technology is really helpful. I mean, again, the jury's out on exactly how we should use it. But that feedback has got to be an important part of it. And I think also speaking to Bethany's point, I think the observational data is good and should give us the hypotheses that we should test. But testing them becomes really important because that's how the only way we really get to causality. And so we're excited, for example, about the next phase of our study where we can use the technology to actually do randomization.
Mm-hmm. I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. You're talking about fitness and some of the mythology about it. Ian, your lab work, as you mentioned, you worked with Apple when it was putting together its fitness apps for the new iPhone. How did that get started? Did they seek you? Did you go to them?
It's actually an interesting story. So we every year at Stanford, we run a conference called Big Data and Biomedicine, the idea that now we're measuring so many more things that we need to think about how we apply them to patient care. And so I just finished a talk there and came off the stage, and I was approached by a couple of people who kind of came up and in rather hushed voices said, you know, we can't tell you who we are or what we do, but we want to work with you.
Mr. Phelps.
Yeah. And so and it was, well, we thought it was the FBI or the CIA or what exactly was this? Well, it turned out it was Apple. And they are so secretive about what they do, you know, in a good way. They like to surprise their customers with new things that they keep everything quiet until the last minute. And this was the beginning of a very, very interesting year-long relationship where we put together these initial launch apps.
Let me ask both of you in a few minutes we have left, what do you think about the driverless car? How is that going? Yeah, Bethany, I'll ask you, then Ewan. How's that going to affect our fitness?
I haven't really thought about it too much with fitness. I've thought about it a lot, how it could help me get more work done. I think we in the world of physical activity promotion are trying to get people out of cars and trying to get people to do more active transportation. So we want people to walk to public transportation. It's also environmentally friendly. So, if they become very cost effective and more people get on the road and there's less accidents, potentially people will be sitting even more. So I guess we'll have to design driverless cars that have a bike in them or something so that we can exercise at the same time.
Yeah, my team are going to think that I asked you to plant that question because I'm obsessed with driverless cars.
Oh, you are?
Yes, I am.
Well, then weigh in on this.
A little sideline of mine. I love technology of all kinds. And so, I think that, I mean, obviously we're all thinking about if the car could take us from A to B, we can get other things done. And other things, of course, could include talking to our families more, could include being creative, composing. I mean, in time, who knows? It could potentially include exercising as well. I think we spend so much time, though, in cars right now, mm-hmm. that if the technology can allow us to be more efficient in any part of our day, then we could spend the time spare, you know, doing exercise and physical
activity. Is there a bit of technology I can give you my blank check question. If any, a blank check to write and buy some or make some technology for fitness, to measure it, to use it. What would you do? What are we missing? Is there an ingredient, a technological ingredient?
Well, I would love to be able to measure the actual output from somebody's heart. We're very good at measuring the heart rate, and we are increasingly good at trying to measure the heart rhythm. But really, when it comes down to it, as a cardiologist, I'm really interested in how much blood can the heart pump per beat.
You guys call it the volume.
That's
right?
Correct, the stroke volume with every beat. Because then I can tell you how much work your heart's doing when you are walking, when you're running, when you're jogging, how much you did all day yesterday. And if your heart starts to fail, as we hope it does not, but if it did, that would give us an online way of monitoring your heart and our treatment of it.
And you can't do that now.
We cannot. It's very, very hard to do that non-invasively. Give me a catheter to stick inside your heart, I can tell you.
Well, you know, those folks who were on before talking about reading the scrolls when they were closed,
yeah.
Maybe they can, you know, read
who
the volume.
That,
Why
yeah.
can't you read the volume?
Right. I would love to be able to do that. So if you write me a blank check, I promise I'll get that one.
Okay. Don't wait too long for that check. Thank both of you. Ewan Ashley, Associate Professor of Cardiovascular Medicine and Genetics at Stanford, and Bethany Barone Gibbs, Associate Assistant Professor, I've just elevated you, Bethany, of Health and Physical Activity at the University of Pittsburgh. Thank you both. for taking time to be
with
us today.
Thank
you
for
having us.
Thank
you.
You're welcome. And we're going to take a break. And when we come back, thinking caps on, Sir Roger Penrose is going to join us. And we're going to go deep into the weeds about the nature of the universe, all kinds of deep physics, about the Big Bang Theory, quantum mechanics. We know you geeks out there are going to love this segment. So stay with us. We'll be right back after this break. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. You know, there are lots of theories about the way the universe works. And while some of them complement each other, they can't all be true. You have your classic weirdness of Einstein's relativity. There's the newer weirdness of string theory and all sorts of theories of theoretical physics and cosmology that seek to answer the questions where the universe came from, how it works, where it might be going. My next guest has done a lot of thinking about all these different theories, and some, he's not such a fan of some of them. He even admits about having his own crazy model of the universe. So Roger Penrose is professor of mathematics at Oxford, author of the new book, Fashion, Faith, and Fantasy in the New Physics of the Universe. Welcome back to the program, Dr. Penrose.
Hello, good to hear you.
Your book takes issue with three very prominent theories, string theory, quantum mechanics, and cosmic inflation. Tell us about the problems you have with them.
Well, string theory, I don't mind the strings. In fact, I rather like the idea when I first heard about them. The problem is more the fact that string theorists found themselves driven to have a space which had, well, initially 25 dimensions and then 9 dimensions, and I found that rather discouraging. I didn't believe that for various reasons.
Mm-hmm. And cosmic inflation, you come down very heavily against that. And people, so it's the winner of a Nobel Prize, is it not?
No, unless it's winning this year.
Alan Guth, cosmic, didn't he win a Nobel Prize?
No, this hasn't. There's always a possibility that it might win, but it's... Yeah. It's certainly become a significant part of current cosmology. The belief is that in the very early stage, a tiny, tiny fraction of a second, the universe indulged in what's called an exponential expansion, and this stretched everything out to an enormous degree. And it was supposed to explain certain things originally, and my trouble with it originally was that I didn't think it actually did the things it was supposed to do for various reasons. It doesn't actually stretch the universe out. So, but it does do other things, which, if it's true, there are certain puzzles which, if it's not true, you have to have something else which does it. These are puzzles to do with the cosmic microwave background, this radiation which is coming in all directions, sort of microwave radiation, yeah. Electromagnetic, coming in from all directions. And there are certain observations about it which are hard to explain without inflation. So the reason that inflation didn't just die, it wasn't stillborn in my view, is that it actually turned out to explain various things which weren't part of the original idea behind string theory, behind inflation theory.
You have your own model called the twisters, you call my own crazy-looking cosmological model.
But the twisters are nothing, well, we don't know yet, nothing to do with the cosmology. That's more as something, not exactly an alternative to strings, although that's the chapter heading. It's a direction you might go in if you don't like strings, or in fact, if you do like strings, because there is a version of twister theory which which involves strings as well. So, but the problem, as I said before, that I have with strings is not the strings, but that the string theorists found themselves needing more than 3 space dimensions, whereas twisters are very much bound up with having 3 space dimensions.
Do twisters solve the problem of uniting Einstein with, you know, general relativity with the quantum world?
They don't do anything like that yet. I mean, of course, one of the reasons behind the idea is that they might eventually do this. Mm. But it's more that, I mean, most people, when they think about uniting quantum theory with gravity or general relativity, they think of what's called quantum gravity.
Right.
The trouble is quantum gravity, to my mind, is the wrong thing to do, because quantum gravity implies that you're using standard quantum theory or quantum field theory and applying it to gravitational theory or Einstein's general theory of relativity, Whereas, in my view, the union between these two great schemes will be something with give on both sides, so that quantum theory has to give as well as the idea of space-time coming into accordance with quantum principles. The quantum principles themselves will have to change.
Mm-hmm. You talk about how difficult it is for new theories to be accepted by scientists.
That seems to be very true, yes.
Tell us about why that is so difficult.
Well, I think the communities get very much interconnected with each other, and if a problem arises, I mean, think of the string theory community. There are certain problems which are accepted as being problems, and then they will figure some way around it and then go a little further, and the whole thing gets a very sort of tightly knit community. And if you introduce something which goes against that view, it's not been going to be looked upon very kindly by these people, because they'll have to change all these things that they've been doing. And I think that's one of the reasons that's the fashion aspect of it. If fashion is something which keeps people going along the lines that they have been going along, and it may be that if there is some fundamental problem with it, they prefer not to look at those fundamental problems.
Is that where the faith comes in? They still have faith in it?
It's a bit like that, too. The faith, though, is not about string theory. The faith, I mean, in my chapter about faith, is about quantum mechanics. And I mentioned a minute ago about the give on both sides. Well, that's basically it. And why do I say there's got to be give on the quantum side? You see, unlike string theory, quantum theory has a huge amount of experimental support. See, some people complain about string theory and they say, well, okay, it's all very well, but it doesn't have any implications that we can measure experimentally. That's not really my objection to it, although that is an objection. My objection to strings is more that the higher dimensional idea, higher dimensional part of it, doesn't really make sense in the physical world in which we live. When it comes to quantum theory, the issue was pointed out by Schrödinger a long time ago with his cat. And the idea is that you have an equation. This is the Schrödinger equation. Another way people refer to this is unitary evolution. And this is in quantum mechanics. See, if you have the state of the world as described by quantum mechanics, the quantum state, then that evolves in time by a very definite equation. And this is the Schrödinger equation, or unitary evolution. And the trouble is, with that equation, as Schrödinger was clear to point out, that you could easily have an experiment in which a cat was dead and alive at the same time, and that's ridiculous. That was what he was more or less saying. So he was arguing that there needs to be something else which goes beyond the evolution that he'd put forward, the Schrödinger equation, and that is a change in the rules of quantum mechanics that we presently understand.
Do we know what that change is or needs to be, or how to get around
it? Well, those of us who believe there should be a change don't necessarily agree about what the change should be. But the change, in my opinion, has to be when gravitational effects become significant. And this can be at a very tiny scale that you might think it was tiny. I mean, there is an experiment, for instance, which is being worked on by Dirk Bouwmeester and his colleagues in Leiden in the Netherlands and in Santa Barbara in the US. And they've been working on an experiment which puts a little tiny mirror. This mirror is about a tenth of the thickness of a human hair in diameter. And this mirror would be put into a superposition of two different locations. So we know in quantum mechanics that particles can be two places at once. It's a strange idea, but you have to believe that sort of thing if you explain things like the two-slit experiment and very many fundamental experiments in quantum mechanics. We know it happens with individual particles, that they can be two places at once, but we don't believe that it can happen to cats. So where's the sort of dividing line between the two? Well, it's not quite a dividing line like that, in my view, but it's something about how long these superpositions can last. So in this experiment by Bouwmeester and colleagues, you try to put this little mirror, as I say, a tenth of the thickness of a human hair, into a superposition of two different locations, but they're not very far apart. They're only about the diameter of an atomic nucleus apart. But you hold it there for as long as you can, and the idea on the scheme that I'm trying to promote, you could only do this for a matter of, depending on details, a few seconds or a few minutes. So this is within the capabilities of current experimentation. It's not quite there yet, but I would expect that within the next decade, they will have an answer to this question.
Mm-hmm. You also take on our idea of the multiverse, the many, you know, unlimited number of universes that we may be living in. You think that's...
One of the reasons people go to this kind of view comes from quantum mechanics.
Yeah.
You see, if you think about the cat again, you see, the view would be, no, the cat has to be in this superposition of alive and dead. In my book, it's not alive and dead. I have the cat going into a room which has two doors, and the doors are, one of them and the other one are open. Only one is open, but it's a superposition of one being open or the other. And it's like a two-slit experiment, but with doors and cats. And the cat goes to some food inside the room. And you would think, well, a cat either goes through one door or it goes through the other door. But quantum mechanics says it would be in a superposition of going through the two doors. And why is it you don't see this sort of thing? Well, the many worlds explanation is that, well, if somebody is watching the cat and seeing it come through, well, whichever door, there would be one person seeing it come through door A and the same person, I should say, seeing it come through door B. But these two instances of the same person would then be thought of as inhabiting two separate worlds. So somehow the world is viewed as splitting. When I say the world, I mean that's the universe, would be viewed as splitting into two versions of it, one which would have the cat going through door A and the other which would have the cat going through door B. And so that's the way they understand this particular conundrum. Mm. And the thing is, that's the faith. People believe, oh, no, you mustn't monkey with quantum mechanics. The rules that we understand have to be held to at all scales. And if you believe that, then yes, you've got to believe that the observer of the cat is somehow split in two and inhabits these two separate worlds simultaneously, and the experience of the observer somehow splits in two. And I've always found this as a reductio ad absurdum. Mm-hmm. And Schrödinger himself was, as I say, pointing this out as a contradiction to experience. And not just Schrödinger, I should say, three others of the fundamental people who founded quantum mechanics, Einstein, de Broglie, and most surprisingly, perhaps Dirac, who was the one who formulated the rules that all quantum mechanics people use. And he himself is on record, and I have a quote in my book where Dirac actually says this, that quantum mechanics is a provisional theory.
Yeah.
And we've got to be prepared for a better theory to come along in which the world does not split in this way, because that's an absurd contradiction. There are other people who believe it does split, and that's the view you're referring to, the many worlds interpretation of quantum mechanics.
Talking with Sir Roger Penrose, professor of math at Oxford, author of the new book, Fashion, Faith, and Fantasy in the New Physics of the Universe, on Science Friday from PRI Public Radio International. Do we need a new physics? Do we need...
I think we do, yes. Certainly. Well, you see, people think about... If they believe that quantum mechanics... And new physics, of course, string theory, isn't really an accepted theory of physics in the sense that it doesn't make predictions that can be measured currently. Mm-hmm. But quantum mechanics makes many such predictions.
And they're very accurate predictions, right?
Indeed. But none of them reach this sort of level of mass displacement. There are quantum experiments, which I think the current record is 143 kilometers. So it's not a question of distance. You can have quantum effects which straddle at least that distance.
That's the spooky action at a distance concept.
Yes, it is. That's exactly
that's how far apart we've observed it happening.
That's the current record of... There are also experiments where you observe stars, and then the distance between one edge of the star and the other, you get interference effects, which mean that the photons that come to you from those two extremities of the star are automatically entangled with each other. This is part of the framework of quantum mechanics.
Are you then saying that we need a way to explain the macro world and quantum, this tiny world of quantum mechanics, with one overarching theory?
It's not as though you have a different theory for each. You have a theory which involves... In my view, it will have to involve Einstein's general relativity. Mm-hmm. So it's when the curvature of space-time starts to become significant. And I have a crazy-looking picture in my book, which is showing the if you have a move a rock, that's into a superposition of two locations, then the space-time goes with it at first, and then there's a point at which one of them has to be chosen over the other. And that happens in a calculable time scale.
How do you get people, if you say it's so hard, and one of the things you point out in your book is that because some of these issues are so ingrained in the scientific community, it's hard to get resources, money, to
that's absolutely true.
Investigate these other ideas. Who's going to get a graduate student to work on some of these new ideas?
You're dead right. It's very hard. I mean, I find this particular, not so much with the quantum mechanics, because I haven't been trying to do this experiment.
Yeah.
It's, as I say, people in the Netherlands and Santa Barbara, and there is money to do that experiment. So whether more would help them do it quicker, I have no idea. But the things where I notice the difficulty of getting funding is for the cosmological scheme. You see, the third topic is the fantasy one, which, as you say, I'm not so happy with inflation. And I think that inflation can't be right. Well, it's a very artificial theory, and I have a picture where you see all the different curves that people sort of draw by hand, more or less, in order this particle referred to as the inflaton, which nobody has really observed it or anything, but it's supposed to be what is responsible for the inflationary scheme.
So, Roger, I've run out of time. We could go on. Your book is 600 pages, something like that.
Read the book then, yes.
Sir Roger Penrose, professor of mathematics at Oxford, author of the new book. This will get you to think very carefully, Fashion, Faith, and Fantasy in the New Physics of the Universe. Thank you for taking time to be with us today.
Thank you very much.
I want to shout out to our New York listeners. Next Tuesday, Science Friday in Studio 360 are getting together at WNYC's The Green Space to celebrate the legacy of the Voyager Golden Record. It'll be a night of live music, cosmic conversation. More info at sciencefriday.com/goldenrecord. Come on out to The Green Space. Plus, we've been on the air for 25 years, and I know I can't believe it either. We're going to have a big gala celebration on board the Intrepid Sea, Air, and Space Museum in New York. That's October 15th. If you want to come out and celebrate with us, it's going to be crazy. Go to sciencefriday.com/gala. Charles Berkowitz is our director, senior producer Christopher Intagliata, our producer Alexa Lim, Annie Minoff, Christy Taylor, Katie Heiler, Luke Groskin, our video producer. Today we had engineering help from KQED, from Monte Carlos and Dan Bringer. Thanks also to Howard Gelman and all the folks at KQED for welcoming us to their home. And they're making space for us today during their peak pledge drive. So pitch in and support Science Friday and all the great shows you hear on all your local public radio stations today. Also, thanks to our production partners at the City University of New York. I'm Ira Flatow in San Francisco.